You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 21st to the 27th of January 2016. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by books editor Karen Shook, deputy news editor John Morgan, and acting features editor Paul Jump. Queen's University Belfast conservation biologist Neil Reed is fulfilling a childhood dream and working in a cloud forest where the natural wonders and the need to defend them can push the region's dangers out of mind. He's written our latest Outer Limits feature this week, and Paul will have some words about that very soon. He'll also mention our second feature, which is about the state of computer science. Plans to recreate multiple tuition fee caps linked to different tiers of the Teaching Excellence Framework will increase complexity without enhancing teaching quality. That's the opinion of some in the higher education sector. John Morgan reports on that this week in the lead news story. And Karen is here, which can mean only one thing. It's the regular roundup of our weekly books section. First, Paul, to you. A couple of great features this week. First and foremost, the latest in our Outer Limits series, which looks at researchers doing work perhaps in more unusual surroundings.
Yeah, unusual, or in this case rather dangerous by the sounds of it, although Neil very much plays down the dangers. But yes, he works in cloud forests in Honduras, which are very pretty but very inhospitable places, very high up, very wet, full of all kinds of poisonous nasties, some of the worst snakes in the world, or best, I suppose, depending on who you want to kill. Scorpions.
I hope nobody said Neil there was a vendetta in that.
Oh no, I'm sure they didn't. He relishes going there anyway. He says actually some of the worst perils are the bacterial ones, and he sort of describes getting some hideous vomiting, stroke, diarrhea, bug in torrential rain, wandering through knee-deep mud to evacuate from both ends, then falling asleep and waking up in a hallucinogenic state covered in termites.
Right.
That's not everybody's idea of a holiday.
Really covered in termites, or was that part of the hallucination?
Well, that's a good question, yeah. Perhaps we'll never know.
It's amazing, isn't it, the sort of lengths to which scholars will go to carry out their research. I'm trying to think off the top of my head, this series has had people down in caves that have lain uncovered for hundreds of years, people heading out into the mountains in Nepal, really do sort of push the boundaries to get to the real nub of what they're looking into.
They do, although what comes across in most of them is just how much people relish doing this. I mean, it may not be for the likes of landlubbers like you and I, but, you know, the people actually do this. I mean, Neil very much talks up the positives, you know, these birds called resplendent quetzals, which are sort of a bit like birds of paradise that he likes to get up at dawn to watch, you know, contributing to the dawn chorus and that kind of thing. So he very much sees the positives in it. I mean, the nearby city that he goes to, it's worth saying, is one of the most dangerous in the world as well. But he cheerfully says that although some of his staff members have been mugged for valuables, no one's ever been hurt, so that's all right then, isn't it?
Very good. Now, well, that's on page 40 this week. The other feature, the cover feature in fact this week, is an altogether different world, the world of computer scientists. And not that they don't go venturing out, of course, into the wilds, but John Gilby, who teaches computer science at Aberystwyth University, has written this one, writing in a personal capacity. It's a subject that comes up quite a lot, most notably perhaps because of its surprisingly poor graduate employment rates.
That's right, yeah. It's worth saying actually that John has gone out into the wilds for this one, specifically Silicon Valley. He's done a bit of a tour of various bigwigs there to sort of talk about what computer science graduates are going to need. And yeah, all of this arises out of concerns about the employability of computer science graduates. There's currently a review going on in the UK, chaired by Sir Nigel Shadbolt of World Wide Web fame, looking into this issue. I mean, the figures aren't startling. I think it's about 11% computer scientists are unemployed after 6 months. That's according to the DALI survey.
It's more than anyone else.
Well, that's the thing. It is a couple of percentage points higher than anybody else. various reasons suggested why that might be. One is that computer science attracts, you know, students from a sort of essentially a range of abilities. You know, it's in some senses a victim of its own success that, you know, the high numbers of students it's got from sort of non-traditional backgrounds and that kind of thing may be contributing to that. But anyway, the Shadbolt review, originally this feature was timed to sort of coincide with the findings of the Shadbolt review. Unfortunately, they've been delayed until next month, but Nigel has written us 500 words sort of giving a sense of what his findings are. But yeah, John himself has mostly sort of talked about the kind of very wide skill sets actually that computer scientists are going to need in the future. It's not just about being able to write code, it's about, you know, communication skills, horizon scanning, you know, very much being adaptable and thinking about end users and all that kind of stuff. So it's quite an interesting read.
Indeed, yeah, check that out on page 34. You'll also find it on timeshighereducation.com. Just click the features button if you scroll down on the homepage. Over to our news section now. John, you've got our lead story this week, and it's all about the Teaching Excellence Framework.
So the Green Paper consultation, which included the plans for the TEF, closed on the 15th of January, and I've had seen sight of some of the responses, and it's fair to say that there's quite, you know, a rough reception for that key proposal to link the TEF to fee rises from the sector. I mean, the TEF broadly, I think, you know, people at universities and the organisations that represent them accept the idea that there should be you know, attempts to prioritise teaching more and broadly accept the principle of the TEF. But Universities UK and Guild HE in particular, the sector's two representative bodies, have criticised the Green Paper's plans to create three or four different TEF award levels, which would each result in a different fee cap from 2018 onwards. Mm. And the document says that, you know, the Green Paper says that these rises in fees would be sort of a maximum of inflation. There wouldn't be any rises beyond inflation. But some people have argued that actually there wouldn't be, you know, much point in going to this all this bureaucratic effort to just link to inflation-only rises, and this could actually be paving the way to a system of truly variable fees. But UK says in its response that creating a number of different fee caps linked to different tiers of the TEF will significantly increase the burden of complexity and bureaucracy without achieving the desired aim of enhancing teaching quality. I don't think it's necessary or proportionate to found the TEF on a multiple fee cap system. And speaking to Stephanie Marshall, the HEA chief executive, she had a similar message expressed in stronger language that this system of multiple tiers of TEF and fee caps would walk right into the territory of a bureaucratic nightmare. And I guess this all adds up potentially to a problem for Joe Johnson, the university's minister. You know, if the main organisations in universities are, and we've still got to get the responses from Oxford and Cambridge as well, and they obviously have quite an influence and they could be quite critical, if you're getting that kind of rougher reception on that key element of the link between TEF and multiple fee caps, that could be quite a big problem for him, particularly as he's battling to get a higher education bill to implement the Green Paper.
And you're a man very much with his finger in these Westminster circles. Indeed, David Cameron, I believe, himself quoted from your interview with Ed Balls recently. Joe Johnson frequently quotes from your pieces. Do you get a sense that this consultation will be taken seriously, that these responses will be considered, that it will lead to a more informed piece of legislation, or is it just lip service, as so often these consultations can be?
You're right, consultations normally are about you know, purely a fig leaf. The government's made a decision and it needs just to go through the sham of appearing like it's listened to people. I think in this case, as I said, particularly Oxford and Cambridge, but also UK, they're quite, you know, they're high profile. Oxford and Cambridge have, they say something, it sort of echoes through the national press. it could be quite damaging to try and press ahead, for the government to try and press ahead with this TEF link to multiple fee caps if there is significant opposition from universities. So whether it will change remains to be seen, but it certainly would represent a significant obstacle and potential difficulty for the government.
Presumably a relatively inexperienced minister is potentially more likely to be open to persuasion than perhaps somebody who's been in the job for a few years and has formed his opinions already.
Yeah, and you know, the idea of the TEF could go forward without the link to fees. It's possible to do that. It just wouldn't have that big financial incentive, but he could possibly argue that he had got through the principle that there does need to be much more attention paid to teaching quality in universities.
Indeed. Read all about that story on page 6 this week. And apologies for my dreadful mixed metaphor earlier. Finger in Westminster circles.
I know, that doesn't sound nice, actually.
Well, that is our circuit. Well, most of them.
Indeed. I think you said I'd been in David Cameron's mouth earlier.
Well, yes, indeed. Well, less said about that, the better. Yes, I'm moving on before the other joke that's currently in my head comes out of my mouth. Karen, the book section this week.
Right, some academic rigour and no more frightening mental pictures. This week our shelf life star is Frank Trentman, Professor of History at Birkbeck University of London. His new book is called Empire of Things, How We Became a World of Consumers from the 15th Century to the 21st. And perhaps fiendishly, the book is so beautifully made, absolutely gorgeous, that if you thought you were immune to consumerism, as soon as you see this book, you won't be. As always in Shelf Life, I get my star of the week or of the fortnight to talk about books that were important to them. His first exposure to classic fiction came on vinyl records as a child, listening to the rattling chains in Alexandre Dumas' The Count of Monte Cristo, and, because he is, of course, a German academic by birth, Karl May's Tales of Red Indians. Winnetou, the barely plausible young chief of the Apache, Karl May, and his heritage is a fascinating quirk of German popular literature. Also this week, Danny Dorling reviews Ronald Formisano's book Plutocracy in America, How Increasing Inequality Destroys the Middle Class and Exploits the Poor. This book looks at things such as, well, he claims that U.S. society has become predatory, and in particular, one example he cites is for-profit universities that prey on armed forces, veterans, and low-income students, and more to the point, through their federal education loans. Anyone looking for any similarity with the UK? Well, answers on a postcard. Also this week, Shahid Abari of Queen Mary reviews a fascinating book by Niall Green called The Love of Strangers, What Six Muslim Students Learned in Jane Austen's London. These students, six Persians studying from 1815 to 1819, they weren't allowed as students at Oxford because it was a Christian institution. Interestingly, when they were there and observed it, the word they hit on to describe Oxford was madrasa. That was the thing it looked most like to them. They also discovered that if you go into a Turkish bath in Leicester Square, don't try to henna your beard. People won't like that. And if you tumble out of a carriage when going to Cambridge, don't look up English women's dresses. They're not wearing anything underneath. And it was not a pretty sight, said the diarist. Also this week, Ivor Gaber, former lobby journalist and now professor of journalism at Sussex, reviews a book by Helen Margetts and her colleagues, Political Turbulence, How Social Media Shape Collective Action. One of the interesting findings of this, or one of the arguments made, was that social media certainly helped to facilitate Corbyn mania. And this week, our book of the week, the amazing physicist Lisa Randall and her new book, Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. Lisa Randall is not only an extremely eminent physicist, but a best-selling and brilliant writer. This book will tell you all you need to know and then some about the Oort cloud and whether the CD-shaped Milky Way bobs up and down, and if so, what that had to do with the dinosaurs. Our reviewer, Marcus Chown, takes issue with some of it, but the book itself is a stonking read.
Thank you, Karen. An eclectic mix as ever. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, you can do so at timeshighereducation.com or find us on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.